While we're waiting for Rembrandt, I'll just say welcome to everyone to this seminar on the notion of the concept of the self in the Bhagavad Gita, and particularly in the two commentaries by Shankara and Ramanuja. And it's interesting, I think, that these different commentaries point to the openness of the text. It's a text that's very open to different understandings and different interpretations, and it just is evidence for the richness of the text and its tenacity through time. So these readings are pre-modern. They reflect their times. They reflect understandings of what they knew of the world, and they reflect understandings of what they understood a person to be. So it does raise a question. I mean, so today I'm going to give you some preliminary remarks, talk a bit about Shankara. I'm going to focus on Shankara's commentary today on the first few verses, and first two verses, I think. And then we're going to read it. I'll speak, but then do chip in. It'd be nice to have a more of a discussion-based class rather than just a lecture. And next time, we're going to compare it to Ramanuja's text. So I've got some preliminary remarks to make first. So the question is, why look at these texts and these authors' understanding of the self? There are historical reasons that these authors are crucial to understanding the understanding of Indian philosophy. And while there's been some debate about whether there can, in fact, be a history of ideas in India, there was about 2 years ago, there was a Journal of Indian Philosophy edition that raised that question: can there be a history of ideas? Can there be an Indian history of ideas? Some said yes, some said no. But it's an interesting debate that should be raised. And why that should be raised? Is it because simply not enough is known about history of Indian ideas, or is it because the nature of Indic thought itself is different, that they couldn't allow for there to be a history of ideas? So that's the kind of a background of some of the things I'm interested in here. I think that anyone who attended the lectures of Harunagar Isaacson the other week would have to conclude that there can be such a history of ideas. But is it that the extent of the interest here, the mapping of ideas about the self? Or do these thinkers and texts raise relevant philosophical or even theological questions for the present day? Are these authors relevant? I mean, we're reading Shankara's sort of 8th century or something. Why bother to read an 8th century author? What's the relevance today? There has been some debate recently about this, about the idea of Hindu theology and whether there can be such a thing. Well, if there is Hindu theology in the contemporary world, mostly through the medium of English, then the question raised about the nature of the person are clearly relevant. So I think that Hindu theologians, contemporary Hindu theologians, if there are any, or there are people who claim to be Hindu theologians, obviously these texts about the notion of the self are relevant. So you need important text historical understandings to have the accuracy with which to use these ideas. But as we can trace a history of ideas, say, about the notion of the self in the history of Christianity through to modernity, it is more difficult to do so in the history of Hinduism, partly because of the rupture of the intellectual traditions caused by colonialism. As Jonardhan Guneri has shown, there was a flowering of philosophical thinking in the early modern period, with thinkers such as Raghunath Shiromani, who's 1460 to 1540, and the emergence of what they call the New Reason. But this development stopped around 1700. Central to this New Reason were three concepts. Firstly, that methods of inquiry need to be evidence-based. You have to have evidence-based inquiry. So it's not only philosophical, but it's also sort of an empirical dimension to this. So it's a very broad understanding of philosophy as empirical inquiry as well. which perhaps we're coming back to more in today than in the last couple of hundred years or so in the history of philosophy in the West, anyway. Firstly, the methods of inquiry need to be evidence-based. Secondly, there has to be a stratified conception of the world in which lower levels of atomic analysis are compatible with higher levels of bodies and persons. So that was what these early modern thinkers thought. They were Vaisheshikas and Nyayas mostly, so they understood that the world comprised an atomic kind of level. But how does that relate to the higher level orders of the reality of the world? So the notions of self and world. And they were interested in those kinds of questions. And we're interested in those questions today. What does quantum physics have to say about the mind? I mean, if... what was that experiment a few years ago? Is consciousness relevant even to our understanding of the world? I mean, what's the relation of mind and brain, which is very, very much on the agenda these days? And these philosophers were concerned with these questions. So there was an experiment, wasn't there? I can't remember who it was by now. Bader experiment?
You're talking about the double slit experiment?
Yeah, double slit experiment.
Wave particle
development. Oh, no, not that one. This is the brain. This is they wire people up to be machines, and they show that... that people have to make a decision about a certain thing, and well, they have to press a button when they made the decision.
Oh, yeah. So I know the. I don't know who it was, but I know.
I can't remember. It's a very interesting experiment, and his experiments show that people have made the decision according to their brain chemistry before they press the button, before they were conscious of having made the decision. And that's very interesting. Anyway, so those kinds of questions, the relation between physicality and consciousness. We're very much concerned with of these early modern philosophers rather. And thirdly, then, these there needs to be a new language of philosophical discourse, they thought, which was being developed in the middle of the middle of the 17th century. But much of this was disparaged by later 19th century thinkers, and we have what Ramprasad has called a hermeneutical rupture in the history of Hindu thought. And by the time we get to Vivekananda in the 19th century, there has been a rampant anti-intellectualism that since then has sometimes become virtually identified with Indian philosophy. Ganeri quotes Vivekananda, who writes, quote, "I have heard that... in your country," he's writing a letter to somebody, to some English character, "there is much logic chopping of the Nyaya school. What is there in it? Only pervasion and inference, vyapti and anumana. On these subjects, the pundits of the Nyaya school discuss for months. What does it help towards knowledge of the self?" So that's Vivekananda, sort of very strong anti-intellectualism there, which we've inherited, sadly, and that's still with us today. So we have a rupture then with the colonial period. We have a rupture with traditional intellectual understandings of the world and self. And it's really a question of getting, I think, of Indian theology getting back on track, if you like, and picking up the pieces from where it left off, from where it was disrupted by a sort of metaphorical violence, or physical violence as well. So we have a rupture with colonialism, but we do have an opportunity now for Hindu thinking to come to a renewed self-understanding and to be intellectually relevant once more. If this is to be the case, then the answers to my second question, do these early thinkers raise relevant philosophical and theological questions, then the answer is yes. But a qualified yes, insofar as these ideas about the nature of the self, for example, need to be exposed to critique and need to be brought up to date in ways relevant to contemporary knowledge. So now in these classes, I do not intend to make the ideas about the self in the Gita, Shankara, Ramanuja philosophically relevant. That's not my task, is to make them philosophically relevant here. And I leave that to others to do, in a way. But only to present an account that enables us to have an understanding of what they thought, a kind of usable account, if you like, that we can use. So Shankara, moving on to Shankara, whose dates I'm sure you'll know, 788 to 820 about. Now, as you will know, I'm sure Shankara needs no introduction. There seems to be a lot of interest in Shankara at the moment, isn't there? There's lectures in the theology faculty on Shankara, and Rembert's given readings of Shankara. And now here too. So, for Shankara, reality is unitary. All differences are unreal, and the only reality is being or Brahman. And the ultimate purpose of life is liberation from the cycle of reincarnation, which is knowing and experiencing the true self. So this, Shankara says, is not like arriving at a place. This liberation is not like arriving at a place. Nor is it like dying. It's not like losing consciousness. Nor is it the result of action. You can do ritual, you can meditate, you can act and you're blue in the face, but it won't get you liberation, because liberation is cognition, is knowledge. It's not the result of action. But rather, like the space inside a pot when the pot is broken, or light in a cleaned mirror. So it's kind of negatively defined. So the Jivan Mukta, the one who is Mukta, liberated while living, is non-acting, incapable of ordinary knowledge, which implies distinctions. So ordinary knowledge implies differentiations. But Shankara's, they can't have that in liberation. So from he has to bring in this notion of two levels of truth. So from a perspective of relative truth, the Jivan Mukta, the one who is liberated, behaves like a renouncer. But they can't really, presumably, that they must act in conformity with the ways of the world, because the Jivan Mukta has no differentiated knowledge. So it's very difficult to imagine what that could be. But having said this, most of his work is establishing arguments for his views about reality and the self, particularly against the Buddhists, through commentary on scripture. So in Shankara's Gita Bhasha, his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, we can see his non-dualistic metaphysics, that self and absolute are non-distinct. In his commentary, he begins with the idea of human experience being a transformation of nature, prakriti, an idea that he is taking from the Samkhya school of philosophy, which is dualistic, positing an eternal distinction between the self, the Purusha, and nature or matter, prakriti. It's interesting that the Samkhya school uses the term Purusha, person, really, and not the term Atman, which Shankara uses, which is self or soul. So what's that? There's a blurring of the categories there between self and person. What's Shankara talking about? Is he talking about a person or the soul or the self? And he's really talking about the self, not the person, I think. This nature is governed by the three gunas, the three qualities of lightness, sattva, passion, rajas, and inertia, tamas, along with eight categories of earth, water, fire, air, space, mind, intellect, and ego, ahamkara. So I'll be going into that in presently. He then goes on to expound expounds the text in the light of his non-dualism. So he reads his non-dualism into the text, or reads non-dualism out of the text, if you want to put it that way. And in his commentary on chapter 13, which we're going to look at today, Shankara makes the point that personhood is an error due to limited psychophysical properties, while the self is consciousness without attributes. So ignorance, then, is not a state of the self, it's not a state of the Atman. When there is an erroneous perception, it is due to a defect in the organ, say an eye disease, not due to the subject. This is shown because there is correct perception, again, once the disease is cured. Once the defect is removed, the self is in its true state. The self is always the subject and never the object of perception and cognition. If all objects of cognition are the field, the kshetra, and the subject of cognition is the one who cognizes the field, then it is ignorance to say that ignorance and so on are attributed to the cognizer. Liberation, then, is freedom of the cognizer from the project of attributes, projection of attributes. So those are my preliminary remarks, and we go on to a reading of the text now. Now, in these passages, we can see the style of commentary that seeks to bolster a philosophical position through numerous scriptural quotations. In the text, the field is the world and or the body, and the field knower is the self. The style of the commentary is that there's an introductory comment followed by the verse from the text, followed by a commentary upon it. And if anyone can't follow the text, don't worry. I hope I'll be talking about it in English. But let's look at the opening. We'll leave the opening verse for a minute. We'll just go straight into the commentary. Saptame diaye suchite dve prakriti ishvarasya. I'll read a chunk and then we'll go through it. Trigunatmikashtya bina para samsara hitutvat para chanya jiva bhuta kshetraknya lakshaneshvaratmika yabhyam prakriti bhyam ishvaro jagat utpati stiti laya hitutvam pratipadyate tatra kshetra kshetraknya lakshana prakriti dvaya nirupana dvarena tadvata ishvarasya tatva nirdharanartam kshetradhyaya arabhyate. So saptame adhyaye, in chapter 7, dve prakriti, the two natures ishvarasya of God, were pointed out. The lower, the apara, comprises the three qualities, the gunas, and is eightfold. Is eightfold. The cause of the world of experience, samsara hetutvat, while the other is higher, whose nature is God, ishvaratmika, and whose characteristic is being a knower of the field, and is jiva bhuta, and is living. So he's saying there are two natures. One is lower, and one is higher. The lower one is what we think of as the ordinary person. It's governed by the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, and is eightfold. Now this eightfold thing refers to the Puriyashtaka, the city of eight. Which is a word in the tradition of the subtle body, actually, which comprises the five elements: earth, air, fire, water, and space, and the internal organ, the antakarana, the buddhi, intellect, manas, and ahamkara, manas, mind, and ahamkara, ego, or eye maker, the sense of eye. So those three things, which we identify with with ourselves, which comprise the subtle body, is the lower nature of the self. So, yabhyam prakriti bhyam ishvaro jagat utpati stiti laya hetutvam pratipadyate. So because of these two natures, the prakritis, because of the two prakritis, the dual there, Ishvara, the Lord, is the cause, the hetutva, is the cause of the utpati, the arising, the stiti, the maintenance, the laya, the destruction of the universe, of the jagat. Tatra kshetra kshetragnya lakshana prakriti dvaya nirupana dvarena tadvata ishvrasya tatva nirdharanartam kshetradhyaya arabhyate. Tatra, so this being the case, Tatra, the chapter on the field The chapter on the field, the Kshetradhyaya, Arabhyate, begins an inquiry, anirdharana artham, an inquiry into the truth of God, into the tattva of Ishvara, into the truth of God. If you disagree with any of this, just shout out and we'll create it. Through the door, dvarena, through the door, by the door of an investigation, nirupana, into the two natures, prakritidvaya, that indicates the field, the kshetra, and the field knower, the kshetragnya. So these are just preliminary.
So it's tadvata, I think.
Yes, I haven't. Yes, what's tadvata doing there? I don't know what tadvata's doing there. Rembo. Shankara. Tadvata. What do you think? Sorry, you do, to disturb your. You look at the other. I'll put him on the spot. It's good to put him on the spot.
Which is
I think it's actually a misspelling. I think it must be.
Tadvat.
Yeah.
No, I think it's Tadvat Sham. Ishvarasya.
Oh, Ishvarasya is Tadvataha, yes, of course, yeah. It's possessing that, yeah. Yeah. It's possessing that that nature of those that, which is just described, I think, yeah. So let's look at the next section. Atitanantare antaradhyaye chadveshta sarvabhutanam itiadina, that's a quote from the Gita 12.13, yavad adhyaya parisamaptistavat tantvajnaninam samnyasinam nishta yatate vartante iti etaduktam kena punaste tatvajnanena yukta yatokta dharma charanard bhagavataha priya bhavanti evam artashchayam adhyaya arabhyate. So in the very last chapter, the which is the Advaishta, the non-hating Sarvabhutanam of all beings, and so on.
I've lost you, Professor. Where are you?
The see the passage beginning, Ati Tanantaradhyaye. Sorry, the next page. Oh yes, sorry. This is I pulled this out of a text with six or seven commentaries in it, and it's number one, the very top one.
So you read across.
Yeah. So when you got to the line, if I had had time, I'd have got my scissors out and just done it on one page, but I haven't. So. So in the very last chapter, which is the Advaishta, the non-hating of all beings, all living beings, to the conclusion of the chapter, the state of the renouncers who know the truth, perhaps the nishta, perhaps the state of the sannyasis who are tattvajnani, who are knowers of the truth, as they truly are, has been told. Something like that. What do you think, Rembert?
Well, Nishtha is often used in the sense of perhaps in the English sense of faith, or sort of a conviction.
The directionality of their minds or something like that.
Yeah, kind of what they're sort of firm in. I think that's what he's taking it here as. Because it's the jnani nam sannyasana nishtha. The nishtha of the sannyasins who are tatvajnani.
Yes.
Know the truth. And then he asks, okay, well, what is this by which do they do this?
Yes.
I think it's more specifically
okay, so it has a stronger sense,
So what they're resolved upon.
That's good. So it's not just state, it's resolve, really, isn't it, nishtha? So who they are and what their resolve is. Does it imply, do you think, a state of attainment? In the yogic, it's not a synonym for liberated, is it?
No. But it does imply some sort of a constancy. It's not a momentarily thing, but it's
firm in their being. Yeah. Good. So those sannyasis are nishtha, and they are tattvagya. They have this firm conviction, as Rembert is saying. But what is the knowledge of truth that, because of the behavior of virtue that is declared, makes disciplined people dear to the Lord? What is it that makes these yuktas Priya, dear, Bhagavata, to the Lord? So this chapter is begun, Arabhyate Adhyaya, is for this purpose. So the purpose of the chapter is to tell us who these people who are nishtad, who these renouncers are, and who these people are that are dear to the Lord. And he is talking fairly theistic language here too. Matter of interest. So prakritischa trigunatmika sarva karya karana vishaya Karena parinata purushasya boga pavargartha kartavyataya dehindriya dhyat karena samhanyate soyam sangata idam shriram tad etad bhagavan uvacha. So prakriti nature, which is trigunatmika, which is characterized by the three qualities, is transformed, parinata, into all forms, namely the effects, senses, and sense objects, boga, So you've got boga, apavarga, artha. So prakriti is transformed into these things, into the karya, into the effects, the karanas, the sense objects, and the vishayas. The senses, those are the karanas and the vishayas and the objects of sense. Karya, perhaps effects or objects of everything. It is put together, samhanyate, something that put together by the form of the body and senses of a person, in order to realize both experience and liberation, bhoga experience and apavarga liberation. Arta, whose object is those two things. So it is put together, samhanyate, through the form of the body and senses, the deha and the indriyas, and so on, in order to realize the bhoga experience and apavarga. So is it the nature of the universe is in order to experience world and live for liberation? So it's in a way that line is an answer to that question. Why is there the world? And he's saying it's because in order for beings to undergo experience, bhoga, and also for them to undergo liberation, moksha.
That response to the Heideggerian, why is there something rather than
it is actually something rather than nothing, to undergo experience, to burn off your karma and to get liberated from it. Yeah, and this body, idam shariram, is the combination, I suppose, of these transformations. And then we get the first verse of 13, idam shariram kaunteya kshetram iti abhidiyate etad yo vetitam prahu kshetragnya iti tadvidach, which we might render, this body, O son of Kunti, is that which is known as the field. One who knows it is said to be the field's knower by those who know. Standard verse in the Gita. And Shankara goes on commenting on this verse now, so that his introductory comments are now finished. Idam iti sarva namnoktam vishin nashti shariram iti hey kanteya kshata tranat kshayat kshalanat kshetravad vasmin karma pala nishpate kshetram iti. Iti shabda evam shabde dartakaha kshetram iti evam abhidiyate katyate etat shariram kshetram yo veti vijanati apada tala mastakam yayeya vishayi karoti svabhavikena padeshikena va vedanena vishayi karoti, we got this again, vibhagashaha tam veditaram prahu katayanti kshetragnya iti. So that's by the pronoun this, idam is meant the body, shariram, O son of Kunti. It is called the field because it protects from injury, kshata tranat, because it decays. This is all kind of a play on the ksha, because it decays. And like the field, it brings forth the fruit of action, karma pala nishpate. The word thus, that indicates the field in the text, means in this way. So it is regarded as the field. So So he who knows the body from head to foot knows the field, and Vishayi Karoti creates it as an object or something. What do they call it? A chvi suffix or something? Which indicates a change of state. Vishayi Karoti. So it's not Vishayin, it's not that, it's not possessive. Sorry, where am I? Yeah. So he who knows the body from head to foot, apada or tala, from the surface of the foot, apada must come to the head, knows the field, and it's something that creates it as an object through cognition. Gyanena. Now, this is puzzling to me, actually. This is, which is either spontaneous or natural, svabhavika, or rule-governed, apadeshika. And then, furthermore, he creates an object through perception, which I think he must mean he perceives the body as an object. He perceives the body as an object. Any thoughts, anyone, on any of those verses that we just read? So this Vishi Karoti, he makes it an object.
How is Vishayi working there? Because it doesn't seem like a accusative. It's a.
It indicates a change of state. So it's not Vishaya. It's a compound. I think when you can link it on, it's a shvi suffix or something. Yeah.
So it's a compound.
Yes, compound. Yeah. So it's not possessive. It's not Vishayin. Yes.
Human being, and Alparikam, he says, means the I don't know if it really helps, but he says it's the knowledge that one is the body and not the self, because that's what one can see. It's kind of a further
externalization. Yeah. So the Svabhavika refers to the true nature of the self, its own being or something, or perhaps spontaneity even. And apadeshika, which is something which is rule-governed, is the body. So the self is free, and the body is constrained and controlled by law, rules. But is this Svabhavika, does that indicate, is that a freedom of will? Is that free will? Or is that some other kind of spontaneous freedom, which is a property of the self, which it naturally possesses all the time, so it's overflowing.
I think it's that one, not necessarily with free will.
Yeah.
The body is ruled different in the sense that you fall, you might break some bones, or you eat, you get fat, you don't eat, you die. These are various types of rules, but the self should be eternal and unchanging and not even really localized in the body.
Is it? No, it's not even localized. For Shankara, it's not even localized in the body. It appears to be, but that's due to our ignorance. That's right.
Alpadeshika, is that related to upadi?
Yeah.
There are external constraints on it.
That's right.
So there aren't constraints, and svabhavika would mean no constraints.
No constraints, that's right. It's unconstrained. The self is svabhavika, it's unconstrained. And spontaneous svatantra might be another word. But I think it doesn't mean freedom of will. I think it means this other sense of it's naturally, spontaneously overflowing in its nature and is unconstrained by anything. But it's the body that's constrained and limited.
It might be free from will. The will has to do with desire.
That's right, because the self is desireless. Yeah. That's right, the true nature of the self. So it can't be related to will in that sense. So it must be some other swabhavika, must be some spontaneous overflowing of its true nature.
Intrinsic,
yeah. It's intrinsic to itself. It's self-supporting, I suppose, might be another term.
But it's not describing itself, actually. It's describing the Vedana,
the
cognition, which is either
Svabhavika
or Upadika. So it's either the cognition is Svabhavika, so it's natural, or...
So the Vedana is the sense of feeling as well. It's perception, something like that. The Vedana. So you don't think that Svabhavika refers to the perception of the nature of the self?
No, I think it's just a nature. Anandagiri's comment is not very helpful. I mean, it's really confusing, but he says Svabhavika means Manushyoham. The knowledge or the awareness that I'm a human being.
So
it's sort of a straightforward identification, straightforward cognition.
Right.
Whereas the other one is, he says, because I see it, I'm the body, not the self. So it's a further thing that comes from Upadesha, I suppose, from instruction or something like that.
Yeah. So that's not constrained by the upadis, then, that's Svabhavika here. Which is.
But I think both of them are illusory in a sense.
So Svabhavika might refer here, then, to a limited sense of freedom, or apparent sense of freedom.
Well, because you're making something an object, right? So that means already it's illusory.
Yes,
whether it's Svabhavika or upadeshika.
Yes, good point. Yeah. So Vishaya Karoti, he makes he creates the object of him, which is the body, I guess. Mm. So it's interesting. By the Vedana, by the perception.
Creates the body by the
way. Looks like it. He creates the object, Vishayi, he creates the object through perception. Perception, Vedana, whatever that means, perception, feeling, creates the object, which is either constrained by the upadis, upadeshika, or it's svabhavika. Yeah. So here we've got a limited Svabhavika, so it's not the Svabhavika we were talking about a little earlier. This is a limited Svabhavika by the look of it.
But that the one would be created through feeling and perception does kind of make sense, because it's the body that has the sense organs in it.
Yeah, the body has the sense organs. Yeah. That's how it's divided up.
Sorry, I'm not understanding the difference between the two. The Svabhavika and what's the distinction there?
I think it's go on.
Dwayana Magiri seems to take in the commentary of the Loga. one the whole thing is about the Sharira, which is the Kshetra, which is the field, which is what one knows, and which causes one to know, through which one knows, and so that becomes an object of perception, either Svabhavika naturally, where one just thinks I'm a human being, or as Nagira says it, or Upadeshikena, through instruction that I'm the body, not the self, because I can see it. So there's more sort of rational thoughts involved.
Yeah.
But but it doesn't say anything about the self because it's all about the body here.
Yeah.
So the body is the object of perception.
Yeah, body is the object of perception.
Because that's the kshetra of which the self is a kshetra gyan, the ruler of the self. So he's just talking about the nature of kshetra.
Yeah. So who is the subject of Vishayi Karoti? The self. Yeah. So it's the self that you're self-creation in a sense. You create yourself, the illusory self, because of projection. And yet it's not the projection, not a property of your true nature, of your true being. So it's a bit like you create the self, creates the self by the self. It's sort of something like that. He creates an object, i.e. the body, through perception. I perceive the body as an object. So, they describe him as the knower of the field.
The self, not the body.
Kshetrajna. Katayanti, they, people I suppose, speak of the Kshetrajna. Sorry folks, this is slightly puzzling that.
Why is there both Prahur and
Katayanti?
Yeah, why is it together? Yeah. Prahu, why both? Yeah.
One is past and one is present, so is it kind of like they have spoken and continue to speak, or
they, yeah, I think so. What do you think?
Remember? I mean, the verse says Prahu, so he's just crossing Prahu.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Sorry, yeah, he's just crossing.
Prahu means Katayanti.
Yeah.
Sorry, and it's all relating to Yo Veti Kshetram, and that is Kshetragya. Is it at the beginning, and is that how it works here?
Yeah, I think so.
It's the Yaha, and then that's the Kshetragya.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so he's glossing Prahu there. So as previously, the word thus means in this way. And then it raises the question, who are those who know? They are the knowers of the field and the field knower. So what's the difference then between Kshetra, Kshetra, Nyao? They are the field, and the field knower. Ye Vedanti, those who know. Tadvida, the wise who know. Or is it something like, is this the only knowledge you have to inquire about them? Do we need to know anything more? Well, it says that later, doesn't it? It says, evam kshetra, kshetra gnyau uktau, kim etavan matrena gyanena gyatavyau iti neti uchiti. No, it is said. And then he goes on to the next verse, 13:2. Thus the field and the field knower have been declared. And is this all that there is to be known? No, it is said, and then it goes on to the next verse. So, it's coming up to 2:55, unfortunately. I thought Time's gone very quickly. I'm sorry, folks, we didn't get as far ahead as I thought we would in this. Do apologise. I'll have to read it more carefully as well, I think, some of these passages. So the point is, I think, from what we've read today, we get the sense that although Shankara is a monist, as a non-dualist, he's arguing for the nature of the true nature of the self that's distinct from the body, which is, when we identify with the body, we get this false identification, which is the cause of the cycle of suffering and the cycle of rebirth. But in order to get his non-dualism off the ground, he had to speak in terms of distinctions. So he makes distinctions throughout his commentary about between the knower, between the field and the field knower. He has to, because the Bhagavad Gita says so, and he has to comment on the Gita and to bring the Bhagavad Gita into his non-dualism, which is what he's trying to do. Why comment on the text? It must have been an important text for him to bother to comment on it in the first place, even in the 8th century. He's the first commentator on it, and he wants to bring it into his field of non-dualism through his commentary. And the chapter 13 is particularly interesting because it deals with the notion of the self as the field knower and the body as the field. And so this is what he's doing here. And he's talking about how false identification with the body arises.
Is he the first commentator on the Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To my knowledge. So next time, I think actually we might carry on with a bit more of this, and then we'll definitely get on to Ramanuja as well in the next reading. And I'll give you a handout next time, perhaps a more comprehensive handout with some English on it, and perhaps read the text more carefully for next time. So thanks for attending, everybody, and hope to see you next time. Do take this away and have a read through the verses that we've read.
Well, you say that Gita is an attempt anyway to have a synthesis between Sankhya and Vedanta. It's not that Sankhya's mind is totally so hot. It's absolutely wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's
extrapolating.
It's a Samkhya, yeah.
Coherent, when you're trying to reconcile a basic sort of dualism and all its categories in a non-dualistic system, you want to have certain conflicts and tensions which you've got to reconcile in that sort of coherent philosophy.
I think that's right. It's a synthetic text, particularly Vedanta and Samkhya. And because it's got all these different doctrines coming into it, that's why it's a rich text in a way, and that allows Shankara to draw out his non-dualist reading from it, and also Ramanuja to draw out a qualified dualist, non-dualistic reading.
Can I ask a question? Gita has, in modern times as well, interpreted in so many different ways, sometimes exactly opposite to each other, to suit a certain energy proposed by Gandhi and so on, and it's Vatila.
That's right, yes.
And it's really confusing. I'm not a Sanskrit person. This kind of debate took place in the ancient times, Shankara's time as well. What do you think? The Gita, which is being discussed today, is a different kind of...
I think these debates about the nature of the text took... Well, they did. We know they took place in ancient times as well. It's always been a contentious text. It's always been a text open to different readings and interpretations. And it's always been a terribly important text in the Indian tradition. And then in modern times, of course, you drew attention to Tilak and Gandhi's readings, completely opposite readings of the same text. I mean, it's very interesting. It just indicates the richness and openness of the text, I think, the semantic density that the Bhagavad Gita has that allows these different readings.
So why did you choose Shankara's commentary?
Because it's first, and because Shankara is a very famous philosopher, that was the only reason. And Ramanuja, just because, again, he's a famous philosopher, and he contrasts, he responds to Shankara. But another thing might be to take recently in the Modern Intellectual History Journal, Faisal Devgi and his colleagues did a very interesting edition on the reception of the Bhagavad Gita in the 20th century, looking at Gandhi and Tilak and Ambedkar and the way they responded to the Gita. They found that Tilak said one thing, Gandhi said another. There was a clash. Yes. So I think that we have to go away with, you know, understanding the Bhagavad Gita isn't one thing, but it's semantically dense. It's a rich text.
The use of the word field in itself, I found interesting as well, because that is a word that is coming up in some modern physics as well, in the conception of the world. I don't know that much about it, but my brother knows a bit more, and he talks to me a little bit every now and then on these things, as far as I can understand it. But there is also, is not really new, it's been here for a couple of decades, I think, but there's this thing called digital physics, where they actually do think that the phenomenal world that we live in could be seen as a part of a kind of computer program that we are characters in.
Yeah.
No, this is real stuff. This is real stuff. There are many people working on this who have written their PhDs in this.
A computer program means somebody programmed it.
A kind of computer program.
Yeah. We always use whatever technologies are available at the time, we always use them as metaphors for the self. Which is interesting, but
it is the soul lie in the computer.
Like chariots
in the olden days, chariots, or Descartes used, you know, mechanisms and so on. So now we use computers because that's the most sophisticated technology that we have as models for imaging ourselves. You know, it's interesting that we 500 years time they'll perhaps look at our computer models of the self as we look at Descartes' mechanistic models of the self.
Download the soul.
I'd love to stick a thing in my brain and, you know, like, and download a load of languages and stuff. Like the Matrix. Well, thanks everyone for coming, and see you again soon.